Welcome to the second edition of the Business of Collaboration podcast. In this podcast, we try and answer the following questions. What is innovation? How do people collaborate and work together? Who is behind the most innovative ideas, technology, and knowledge? We are curious about people. How do they innovate? How do they create a new technology or acquire new knowledge? We give them a voice and a platform to share their stories because they are superheroes.
This is your host, Jara Pascual, founder of NoCo and CollabWith. Today, we have the pleasure to talk to Professor John Besant, author of 30 books on innovation management, professor of innovation and entrepreneurship at the University of Exeter in the UK. Professor Besant will be a keynote speaker at the ISPIN Connect Bangkok conference on the 1st-4th March 2020 in Thailand. This podcast, Business of Collaboration, is in collaboration with ISPIN and is all about crisis-driven innovation and the importance how people talk and think about innovation. What are the new trends of teaching innovation? Do you want to know? Listen to our podcast with Professor John Besant. Welcome to the Business of Collaboration podcast. Today we have Professor John Besant, Professor of Innovation and Entrepreneurship at University of Exeter in the UK, and author of 30 books on innovation management. So, Professor Besant, you are a legend here. So, thank you for doing this podcast with us.
My pleasure.
How did you start to work on innovation and becoming a professor on innovation management?
That's a very long story. I've been doing it a long time, but I'll give you a very short answer. I was frustrated. I was an engineer in the chemical industry and became increasingly annoyed that our innovation in products and particularly processes didn't work as well as it could. And my old boss from the university was very helpful. He found an opportunity for me to do a PhD, to do my doctoral studies while working in a company. So I was a participant observer. So I got to observe how innovation happened whilst I was part of doing it. And I enjoyed it so much. I learned a lot, and I've been doing that ever since. So very much a sort of practitioner frustration drive into trying to understand how innovation happens and how we could make it better.
And then you are an author of 30 books on innovation.
Yes, I do like to write, but... I think it's partly about communicating. I realized a long time ago the reason I enjoy teaching is because every time I try and explain something to somebody else, I understand it a little better myself. And there are many different applications of innovation, different audiences. So I've tried over the years to learn how to communicate the lessons we're learning. And of course, it's a moving target. We're every day learning new things about innovation. The game keeps changing. And so there's always plenty to write about.
Yeah, and I think you are right. When you are explaining your complex thinking, maybe it's when you simplify. And that's the most difficult thing, to make it easy to understand from others.
Absolutely. And I think my current personal project is to reinvent myself as a YouTube professor. So it's great fun, but the discipline of condensing a chapter of one of my books into a short series of short 6 or 7 minute videos, that's a challenge. And it really requires you to think through and simplify without losing the essence. So I'm still enjoying the challenges of communicating, but now using video and audio instead of just writing it into books.
Yes, I remember when I was trying to go to Instagram and to explain innovation in Instagram, because it's the Instagram stories, you have 15 seconds.
Wow.
And then I was like, oh my God, that's so difficult. So really, it's a, like you mentioned now, to condense one chapter into 1-3 minutes is difficult. Try to explain in 15 seconds. So I was like, I ask the questions to the followers, do you understand what I am doing? And they say, no. I'm like, oh.
Yeah.
Yes, I think it's crazy. Yeah.
But it's an interesting challenge. Certainly, I'm enjoying co-creating with the students I work with, many of whom are working in industry, and so they're using the online course as a way of learning, and learning through them what works in podcasts and in short videos. That's been a very valuable process. So I still would like to write books, but I think being able to distill the key lessons and to make them accessible and practical via podcasts and YouTube and maybe one day Instagram, that's an interesting challenge.
Yeah, I think so, yeah. You are a keynote speaker for the ESPIN Connect Bangkok. So the ESPIN conference is on 1st to 4th of March this year, 2020, yeah, in Thailand. What will be your presentation about?
Well, I'm particularly going to talk about crisis-driven innovation, which is a theme I've been interested in for some time. I work a lot these days with the humanitarian sector, people like Save the Children or the Red Cross, who very much have an innovation challenge. If you have a natural or, sadly, a man-made disaster, there are a lot of problems you have to solve very fast. It sometimes is a matter of life and death. So innovation is central to what they do. It's surprising that it's fairly recently, only in the last 10 years, that they've been thinking about how do we do this and could we do it better? How do we manage innovation? But what's been interesting to me is that actually what goes on there is very often a fascinating laboratory for learning new approaches to innovation management. And so this idea of learning to innovate under crisis conditions is one which fascinates me, and I'm going to share some ideas in the conference in Thailand.
And how do you come with this idea of the importance of crisis-driven innovation? I remember, I think it was a TED talk with a professor from Harvard, Amy Edmondson. He was talking about teaming. Mm-hmm. And to be creative and how to create the team to solve this crisis. So it was using the example of in the mining problem they had in Chile to rescue the 12 miners.
Yep.
So why do you see this is important to change how the people talk and think about innovation when they are in this crisis problem, you know, when in this crisis situation?
Yeah. It's a great question. I think if I try to distill it, we get very comfortable with innovation. We know how to do it. We know how to be creative and to switch that on and off, how to manage creative teams. We're very good at innovation generally, under what I would call the steady state conditions. When things are a little out of the ordinary, like sadly that mining disaster, or for me the Apollo challenge when the space capsule suddenly was going to crash land, and so they had to do a great deal of very fast, very different problem solving. When you have crisis conditions, you have to work in new ways. And that's a very interesting challenge because most organizations are rather lazy. They don't like to do things too differently. If their systems work, why change them? So crisis conditions force you to think in new directions. And the evidence is from many, many examples in many different fields that when you force people, because you introduce constraints or the situation makes some things impossible, when you force people to think in new directions, they make new connections. They come up with surprisingly and sometimes radical ideas. At an individual level, if you put people in brain imaging, you can see new connections are being forged. The brain is hunting for new possibilities. So this idea of using a crisis, particularly if you can control that crisis, but using crisis as a way of stimulating new lines of thinking, gets quite close to what companies want in terms of thinking out of the box.
Yeah, and we had a prior conversation before the podcast, and you mentioned as well there how it's sometimes difficult to move this crisis-driven innovation thinking from a crisis moment to a normal corporate environment.
Yeah. Indeed. And I think that's one of the interesting parts of it. It seems crazy. Why go looking for trouble? Why would an organization want to construct crisis? But actually, that's quite a powerful tool to change the way people think, to change the organizational mindset. There's a very famous paper from some time back now, but talking about Hyundai and basically how that company, particularly the auto division in its early days, used constructed crisis to kind of put some fire underneath people and make them think in different ways that weren't just trying to catch up, but were trying to do different things in that highly competitive industry. For me, the best example and the one which has had perhaps most influence would be the idea of lean thinking. These days, you'd have to go a long way to find someone who hadn't heard of lean manufacturing or lean services or lean thinking. And it really has changed the way we run our business processes and our physical processes. But lean's origins really go back to post-war Japan and to crisis. After the Second World War, the Japanese economy was in very bad shape, scarce resources. It's a country that doesn't have any natural resources, lack of skills, a lot of the infrastructure destroyed by the wartime bombing, all sorts of constraints. So it meant it was really important not to waste anything. And what became the Toyota production system, but was replicated in many other firms, essentially was saying, out of this crisis, we can't use our old approaches. We have to create new approaches to the way we make stuff, particularly things that don't waste anything. And lean is essentially a philosophy that's all about no waste. But for me, it was born out of crisis. And my experience in trying to introduce lean in many factories around the world was one of the first things you have to do is to create the sense of crisis, to get managers of factories to realize there is a better way, partly by stimulating a sense of crisis. And we had a lot of fun playing games so they could simulate crisis without actually bringing their factories into disaster. But it changed the mindsets and allowed them to begin to think differently. So for me, crisis is a very powerful motivator for thinking differently and for organizations to innovate differently.
Yes, I it's coming to my mind different examples where crisis and scarcity, it was a popular case. Maybe I don't know if it's well known by everyone, but when Adidas, in Germany was the Second World War, and then it was not materials, so it was not leather there. Mm-hmm. So then is when they used the military tents, so the canvas, instead of leather, to create the sneaker. Like, you know, the canvas sneaker, because before it was all about leather.
Yeah.
And I think it was when we went to the ISPIN conference in Florence, I joined the group of visiting the Salvatore Ferragamo group. And then they were explaining a very similar case for Salvatore Ferragamo when they had not leather because it was in a war period, or not the materials we used to construct shoes and footwear. So they were using cork and textiles and whatever they had there in the village in Florence. So it's the same situation, how we can be much more creative and create new products.
Absolutely. That's a great example. I hadn't heard of it, but I shall follow that up. But no, it's that gets to the heart of it. When you can't do something the easy way, when you have no leather, when you have no material or something, then you have to think your way out of the problem. And that may take you down fascinating new tracks. As I say, in the humanitarian sector, this is something that happens all the time. the constraints of a physical situation when perhaps the physical infrastructure is smashed to pieces, you have to invent something new. From that, you may then find new trajectories which come back to the mainstream for innovation. And sadly, we're not short of crises in the world. If you perhaps take some of the terrible things happening right now with climate change, these awful bushfires in Australia, almost certainly that's going to prompt some people to think differently, to find ways not just to avoid that happening again, but maybe to deliver goods and services, to do things in very radically different ways. So to talk about it in Thailand, it's really to challenge the audience to add to their thinking about innovation management the possibility of crisis-driven thinking.
This podcast is in collaboration with ISPIM, a community of members from research, industry, consulting, and the public sector. Join CollabWith at the 2020 ISPIM Innovation Conference in Berlin and help Europe's leading innovation management community address today's critical challenges of global importance. And don't forget, submissions to present at the conference are due January 24th, 2020.
Yeah, and how to force this crisis-driven thinking inside the corporates when they have no crisis. Yeah. So you have as well a workshop in the ISPIM conference in Berlin in June, as well on how to teach innovation. So this is super interesting because apparently everyone is talking about innovation, but it's very complex to understand what is innovation. Apparently, there is this hot discussions always. So what are your best practices for innovation training?
Okay, for me, I think that the first thing is, as a teacher, I've learned that you can't teach people anything. You can't give them an injection of something. You can help them to learn. So I'd see my role as a coach or a catalyst. And I suppose the other thing is I've been trying to do this for 40 years. So what I'm sharing in Berlin will be my experience so far. But I think there are some lessons that we have learned. The first thing is innovation is really about creating value from ideas, whether that's commercial value or social value. My definition is simply, how do we create value from ideas? And it doesn't happen automatically. The greatest idea in the world, see those cartoon pictures, bing, light bulb flashes, a wonderful idea, that may not go anywhere. There's a process, a journey that has to be undertaken to create value from that idea. And the good news is we've now got about 100 years of research on how that journey happens in all sorts of different situations, and there's a pattern. So there are a number of things that can be done to enable innovation to happen and to happen effectively. And for me, the big thing is that they come down in the end to skills and capabilities, things that people and organizations that they work in can learn and build upon. So in a sense, we do have a curriculum. We've got something that we can teach. And there's pretty good evidence that if you do these things, you won't guarantee success, but you can certainly stack the deck in your favor. So that then says we know what we'd like to teach, what the body of knowledge is, how then might we approach teaching it or sharing it, enabling people to learn. And then, of course, I think you come to some fascinating educational innovations. Yes, you can stand up and give a lecture, and that's one way of imparting knowledge, but there are many, many others. And we've, in a variety of different contexts, been looking at novel ways for helping people learn. For example, you can learn a lot through playing games, and there are some very good games around now through which people can learn about innovation. We have a big program with ISPIM, a big what's called Knowledge Alliance, which involves a number of companies, people like 3M or Lufthansa and Deutsche Telekom, companies who are trying to help use games to learn about how to manage innovation. And indeed, I mentioned my own work on trying to get people to adopt Lean. We used a lot of simple games, often based on Lego and other simple things. But by playing games, managers could learn a lot about innovation. So we can play games. We can tell stories. I think storytelling is another powerful way in which we learn about innovation. After all, case studies are really just nicely written stories about how innovation succeeds or sometimes fails. We can do a little bit of drama. We can have innovation theatre. We can do all sorts of different things beyond the traditional classroom to help people learn this core set of skills and capabilities. And so what I want to do in Berlin is to share some of the emerging good practice in that area.
Not to teach, but more educate on what is innovation and how, and to showcase examples, so real life examples of innovation. And this is the reason why I am doing the podcast mm-hmm. and the magazine, for this educational part.
Yeah, and I think we have inside ISPIM a special interest group, which anyone is welcome to join in with, but it's essentially a community of practice. I very much like this concept. Yes. It's people in all sorts of contexts. Yes, of course, there are university professors like me, but there are people in primary school teaching, so this is not just the higher education world. There are certainly people in companies, trainers, coaches, managers who are concerned to build up capabilities. I've mentioned my own work in the humanitarian sector. A huge part of that is training people, these very powerful and passionate field workers, training them in some of the skills to enable innovation. So there's a very large community of people with a shared interest in how could we help others learn the innovation skills. And so what we're trying to do with the special interest group is have workshops like the one in Berlin to participate in research projects looking at different methods, like our Gamify project, like the Vision project, like a project we just concluded, which was looking at 8 novel methods for training innovation. In lots of ways, we're trying to use this community in just the way you describe, as a way of sharing what we're learning and building towards good practice.
Yeah, this is a very good topic, I might say, because even in corporates, there is this lack of knowledge, the basic knowledge about what is innovation. And I remember having these hot discussions all over and over, like endless mm-hmm. discussions. And I said, like, can we start only simply doing innovation? Because there is this misunderstanding. And it's incredible, it still is there. I remember like going to work in another companies, and always this question was misunderstood. Mm-hmm. And even my superior said like, but can you bring a flying car to showcase in the innovation event? And I said like, what? Oh my God. and this is maybe painful situation or I face and say like, oh my God, we have too much work to do in this sense. So my question to you is now, what is innovation?
Okay, well, as I said a little earlier, for me, my working definition, and I guess over the years I've simplified it, it's creating value from ideas. And that's in all sorts of contexts. Of course, in any business, it's about creating commercial value, products and services which they can sell successfully. But much of our world is about public services. So it's not about making a profit, but it's about delivering education or healthcare. The whole field of social innovation, including my humanitarians, is about trying to make the world a better place. Even in our daily lives, if we are involved with a scout group or a local community shop, these are all things where we would want to innovate. So we're trying to create value from new ideas. So for me, that's a very generic, all-embracing definition. The big question is how. I guess I've spent a lot of time, and you've just touched on it really, talking with organizations who make rather simplistic assumptions. They think, for example, innovation is just about technology. I'm an engineer. I love technology, but huge chunk of innovation isn't about software or wonderful new gadgets. It's about the way we do stuff. It's about human skills. It's about the way we organize ourselves. It's that kind of softer innovation. So there are elements of that that we need to think about. I think there are other myths. One of them is that there's somehow a hero, man or woman, who is the great innovator. It's almost like Superman or Superwoman. The reality is, of course, innovation is a team sport, that everybody has the skills to be creative. If you look at any bunch of kids, you can certainly see that. So we are all creative. And the evidence is if we create together, we can be so much more successful. So innovation really has always been a multiplayer game, and it's all about collaborating and working together. So it's not about looking for the next Steve Jobs or Bill Gates or whoever our hero innovator is, but rather recognizing this is something that happens quietly, very often, inside any organization. And there are a lot of skills around helping that happen better as a team sport.
And then the other question, because innovation is not happening for one person, so we need to work mm-hmm. together to bring this value. So what does it mean, collaboration for innovation?
Well, I think that's a huge thing. I mean, at the team level, the evidence is that whilst one mind can contribute many creative ideas, the synergies you get when you have more minds aren't just more volume of ideas. You have more different kinds of ideas. And sometimes the interaction stimulates people to think in new directions. So one reason why we do so much innovation in teams is to exploit that effect. But I think that for me, as a student of innovation, the 21st century has been fascinating. If I were to make a crude generalization, most of our interest in looking at innovation in the 20th century was at the individual enterprise level. And we might talk about the odd partnership with key suppliers or key customers, but essentially the focus was on the individual enterprise and what it did. These days, it's changed completely. These days, we talk about open innovation, collaborative innovation. Look how often this word innovation ecosystem is beginning to appear. What that's really telling us is something we have known for a long time, we've just not really focused on, which is innovation is hugely about interactive value creation. And so collaboration and learning to collaborate, particularly in a world where there is so much knowledge outside the organization we're in, and now so many channels, particularly digital channels, to help us reach that, in a sense, the game has shifted hugely. It's a very rich set of opportunities, but we have to learn some new skills about collaboration. So for me, I think collaboration has become perhaps the most important theme in innovation in the 21st century.
Yeah, wow. That's why the podcast is called Business of Collaboration. Because for the core of the innovation, for me, was the collaboration. To work together.
Absolutely, yeah.
You are listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast, a production from CollabWith and the NoCo community. We are an online community helping businesses connect with experts to solve innovation challenges and create consortiums. We do this through a custom-built environment where academics, startups, and businesses collaborate to innovate and accelerate. Together, we break down the barrier between academics and the business world. Innovation has never been so accessible. And now, back to our podcast.
And I think it's still something that we're learning how to do. I'm sure in other podcasts you've explored this, but we have to learn to find different partners. We have to learn to work with them, to form relationships, to learn to trust and really share. And that's not just about intellectual property, though that's a key part. It's all sorts of other things. But eventually we can get to powerful performing collaborations. But they don't happen by accident. I speak to a lot of companies and other organizations who say, yep, we have an open innovation strategy. That just means they're going into a kind of global supermarket and picking up new ideas from new people. But to make those ideas create value, particularly in a collaborative way, there's a lot of new skills that we have to learn.
Yeah, and that's a huge point you are touching now. Open innovation is not getting ideas from everywhere. So it's like building together.
Yeah.
And it's not, we can say, an idea forum. Like it's much more. Mm-hmm. And this understanding is part of the innovation training, teaching, education.
Absolutely. And I think for me as a teacher, as I said earlier on in the podcast, it's a moving target. Innovation is always changing. So even if we think today we know how to manage it, tomorrow we'll have to learn to manage something new. So in that context of where are the new themes in innovation, where even the smartest organizations have to learn new tricks, it would be in this field of collaboration.
Now we are going more to personal questions. Mm-hmm. And now there is this bridge question. What is the thing you are most proud of?
Well, I suppose it's a very interesting question. I'm very conscious that we have, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of research. And I began my research career, looking at innovation in one company. Now, we've got about, as I say, 100 years of this kind of research. So thousands of people have written about their experience. University people have studied it. Company people have reported success and failure. We've got a body of knowledge. I suppose for me, I see my role these days as curating. It's like having a wonderful museum or art gallery. And my job is to try and bring the exhibits to the public's attention and help them understand and enjoy them. And so what am I most proud of? It's things I've done in that direction. I am proud of the book or the textbooks that I've written. And increasingly, I'm trying to weave that across to the way I teach and this YouTube idea. But I'm proud of being a curator and enjoying that. I think the other side is another word beginning with C, being a catalyst. As an engineer, I've never been a very theoretical person at the university. I've spent a lot of time in consulting and in various projects which are trying to make change actually happen or help organizations change. And I think I spent a long time in the 1990s working with the United Nations in various places, trying to help bring the ideas of new manufacturing, of lean thinking, of trying to help organizations innovate by actually working with them to help them change. And I've got some wonderfully happy memories of going to factories and changing them. I didn't change them myself, but I planted some seeds. And then the managers and the workers were able to make different things happen. They discovered new ways of working for themselves. They innovated. And I'm proud that I was a catalyst in some of that.
And then the other tricky question is, and the failure you were learning the most?
Yes, I thought long and hard about this. I've made a lot of mistakes. But I think when it comes back really to this idea of trying to help people learn, I had a wonderful opportunity back in the late 1980s. We were invited to create a program, a master's program from our university for companies. And they would send their senior managers for week-long residentials to learn about managing innovation. And we had a very good university team. And we had tremendous support from big companies, people like IBM, Hewlett-Packard, Procter & Gamble. Some of the top names sent some good managers. I failed in the sense that I was confronted with a room of about 20 managers who were smart. And I tried simply to do what I mentioned earlier, to inject them with knowledge, as if somehow I was the high priest. They knew nothing and I was going to bring them this wisdom. They, of course, knew far more than I did, but from a different angle. And they weren't very impressed. And by the end of the first week or the first couple of weeks, the course wasn't going well. And I was very fortunate to have a good friend who understood very much about experiential learning. And he introduced me to David Kolb's learning cycle. And it's a simple model if you don't know it, but it basically says we don't learn just by having an injection. We typically have experience. We reflect on that experience, distill some ideas about that, and add what we've distilled to what we already know to enhance our concept. And then we try those new ideas out. So it's a cyclic process. And learning to approach this this training, this learning about innovation as a joint effort in which we were all learning, we just were coming at it from different sides, was transformative for me. From that moment on, the course got better. People said they learned a lot more. I certainly learned a lot more, but it was essentially a cooperation in shared learning. So my failure was trying to be a traditional academic and teach people what they needed to know. My subsequent learning, and it's helped me all my teaching life, is how much it's a partnership with the learners.
That's a very good insightful and meaningful way of looking. Like, you are innovative yourself as well in the way of teaching. Like, you know, you like, is the learning approach and growth learning based on learning all the time?
I like to think so. I mean, I think what drives my innovation in teaching isn't just a passion for new things. It's trying to improve the ways in which that cycle can operate. But the pleasure comes when we do it interactively. It's back to the collaboration thing we talked about. It's a shared process and one which benefits everyone.
Yeah, and I am thinking about the question, the learning process online versus offline. Mm-hmm. Because maybe in the classroom you have more interaction, you mm-hmm. feel as well the audience, but then when you are online, sometimes that's there is a next level of complexity.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's two different things, and for me, I'm still in the middle of it. But I think over 40 years, I've learned how to work quite well in classrooms, whether they're 200 people, which is one of my master's courses at the moment, or 20 people. So I can interact in different ways, and I can optimize the way I do that. What I found with the online world, of course, is that if I simply were to film my lecture and broadcast that, it would be very ineffective. So I've had to learn a lot about how do people consume from a very different place, on their own, perhaps in much more split timing, so they don't sit for 40 minutes and listen. They may snatch the learning in short bursts. But particularly, how can I encourage them to reflect when they're working along on their own?
Yeah.
I don't have all the answers. It certainly made me think in different ways, and I'm pleased with the feedback on the pilot programs I've been running in this fashion. I guess my ideal, if you ask me as a teacher, would be to mix the two, to periodically bring those online learners into the offline world, to actually confront them, to engage with them face to face and learn together. I think that would be the optimum, and sometimes that's possible. But certainly I think there's a great deal of innovation opportunity in this learning space, and I'm still quite low down the learning curve.
So now we are going to more personal questions. What is your favorite place for holidays?
These days it's Cyprus in the Mediterranean. It's a beautiful island lays claim at least to having invented wine, and certainly they do make some very nice wine there. But it's a beautiful place, beautiful climate, and we've been going there so often. I guess I've traveled a lot around the world, but Cyprus brings a lot of that together. And I have to say, it speaks very much to entrepreneurs. I think if ever there's a nation of natural entrepreneurs, it's those Mediterranean folk in Cyprus.
Oh, interesting. So, other question, how did your mornings look like?
It's a great question. There's a theory and a practice. The theory is I wake each morning quite early, and I'm trying to teach myself how to draw. So when I'm even half awake, I'll try and draw something. And that's lovely, and my brain wakes up. And I'd love to write a novel, so I'm trying to write a little bit of a novel and various other things. I'd like to think I could do some yoga. So all the theories, all these very good, positive things. The reality is I have a daughter. I'm very fortunate. I remarried, and I now have a 3.5-year-old daughter. So from the moment she comes in the door, and it's often very early in the morning, all of my intentions disappear, but it's lovely, and I'm part of her world. So that's my morning. It's mostly chaos, but lovely chaos.
So, and then for the breakfast, is coffee or tea?
Oh, tea. I'm an Englishman. There are some things you can't change.
What are you doing with your spare time and weekends?
Well, apart from the 3.5-year-old, my daughter Lara, I love music. I've played in bands. Indeed, when I left university, I didn't want to be an engineer. I spent a year in a rock and roll band, Ooh. Which was fun. So now I play in 3 or 4 bands locally, and I go to various places. So music is perhaps the big and still very enjoyable thing. Trying to learn different instruments, trying to play with different people. It's all about innovation again.
What is your favorite music then? If you're a musician.
Oh my gosh. We have a program in the UK which has been running for 40 years or so, where you give people the choice of 8 pieces of music that they can take to a desert island.
And oh, really?
It's fun. Oh, cool. It's a wonderful program. It's a very clever concept. And of course, you learn a lot about the people and they explain their choices. But of course, most of us who haven't yet been on the program still try and think of that. I don't know how I would answer the question. I just love so many different styles of music. If you really pushed me, I think probably Bach. I find the cello concertos are... They're very spiritual. They're solo instrument. They're very meditative. If I'm ever trying to write something, that's the music I put in the background. If I just want to listen with my mind open, bit of Bach. So yeah, probably if you pushed me, I'd choose Bach. But Bruce Springsteen would be a close second.
Quite interesting. So now about the books, because you are an author, and you write so many. Not only papers, but books on innovation. So in your life, if you can recommend some books, which one you will recommend?
Gosh, that's another tough question. In the world of innovation, I think, and one reason I write books, I think books can change our thinking. We've become a bit obsessed with writing short academic papers because that's the way the game gets played. But for me, a book allows you to explore ideas in more depth and over more time. And the book that I still would recommend, even now, though it's 20 years old, but it certainly challenged my thinking as a teacher and researcher in innovation, would be Clay Christensen's Innovator's Dilemma. It really was a powerful challenge, very well researched, very well written, and most of his other books since then have built on those core ideas. So if there were one innovation book, that would probably be the one for me. But I read lots of fiction. I love reading. It's something, none of my spare time pleasures. And I like poetry. And I suppose if I went on this desert island, I'm allowed to take some music. That was part of the story. But you're also allowed to take one book. And I like the American poet, T.S. Eliot. I think he wrote he was a very innovative poet for his time. But he also wrote in the latter part of his life in a very spiritual fashion. So I'd take a volume of T.S. Eliot's poetry. And if I had to just pick one, it would be the Four Quartets.
Wow, impressive, John. So thank you very much, John, for this podcast and this conversation and all the insights. It's incredible. I think we can even do 20 podcasts only with you and have a great conversation every time. So thank you very much, John, and see you in the ESPN.
Thank you very much. It's been a very enjoyable conversation. Thanks.
So now I thank you for listening to the Business of Collaboration podcast. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review over on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcast. You can find a summary of this podcast at podcast.collabwith.org. See you next week.